loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we take a look at the week in review. It's been a big week for the news, and today we're going to come back and review the biggest stories from the week. We'll talk about the growing war danger with Iran, the upcoming U.S.-North Korea summit in Singapore, the hearing on Gina Haspel for the CIA director's position, and the recent news that early on in the Trump administration, you could pay his personal lawyer for access to the president. And then in our second segment, we go to the midterm congressional elections. Every Friday, we talk with the Lookman Nation, where we'll cover the primary races earlier this week and the general mood as the midterms start to gear up.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, parliamentary elections will take place in Iraq tomorrow, and that will serve as the basis for the next government. The race this year is splintered by intra-sectarian divisions and fragmented Shia, Sunni, and Kurdish factions. This is the fourth election in Iraq since the U.S.-led invasion of that country. Next, former Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad will be Prime Minister again after pulling off a major upset in this week's election in that country. Mahathir, at 92, will be the world's oldest leader. Even more importantly, he came out of retirement, switched parties, and defeated the incumbent Prime Minister, a man he had mentored. Then, researchers in China and the United States have figured out a way to send commands to smart devices like Alexa and Siri that are undetectable to the human ear. They can make the devices dial a phone number or access a website, but in the wrong hands, they can open the door to your house, wire money, or buy things online, all while embedded in music. And then the opioid epidemic raging across the country continues making headlines as politicians and grassroots activists debate the way forward. Access to housing has become a central issue in the crisis. And finally, it's Friday. We'll take a look at the worst and most misleading headlines of the week. And in other headlines, another school shooting happened this morning just outside of Los Angeles in Palmdale, California, around 7 a.m. Pacific time. One person was wounded in the shooting at Highland High School, and the alleged shooter is in custody. There were additional gunshots reported at a nearby elementary school, but those remain unverified. At least one unarmed Palestinian protester has been killed and at least 167 wounded by Israeli forces in the final Friday demonstration before Nakba Day next Tuesday. The series of actions began on March 30th and have been named the Great March of Return. According to a statement by Save the Children, more than 250 children have been shot with live bullets since the end of March in the Gaza Strip. Approximately 50 people in total have been killed and at least 8,500 wounded. Hundreds of protesters rallied in Tehran against the U.S. decision to withdraw from the JCPOA, or the Iran nuclear deal. Ayatollah Ahmed Khatami, one of Iran's elite clerics, said about the U.S. government, quote, "They have always been after the toppling of Iran's regime, and this exit is in line with that aim," unquote. After voting against several of Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte's initiatives, the first female Supreme Court Justice, Maria Lourdes Sereno, has been ousted from her seat. Sereno voted against extending martial law to a nearby island and to burying former dictator Ferdinand Marcos in a national cemetery for heroes. Activists say that this is one more step taken by Duterte toward the consolidation of a dictatorship. Those are today's headlines. Next up is the week's news and review, including the Iran-Israel strikes, the Haspel hearing, the date set for the DPRK talks, and Michael Cohen's pay-to-play scheme. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the big stories of the week. We're going to take a look at the week in review. It's been a big week of news, and today we're going to come back and review the biggest stories. We'll talk about the burgeoning war danger against Iran, the upcoming U.S. DPRK summit, the hearings on Gina Haspel's potential confirmation, and the recent news that early on in the Trump administration, you could pay his personal lawyer for access to the president. Well, I don't think it's us paying the lawyer, but you know what I mean. We're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. He's a human rights and labor lawyer who is the author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. And from New York by Ted Rawl. He is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Dan and Ted, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dan Kovalik, you also have an upcoming book about Iran. And let's start with Iran. I mean, this week, as predicted, not surprising, but perhaps shocking, the U.S. government withdrew from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action formally. Anyway, your take.
Yes, well, I think, as you say, I mean, it was shocking, but not surprising. Obviously, Trump has been signaling he was going to do that for some time, and obviously he was being pushed to do it very hard by Benjamin Netanyahu, who he seems to defer to on many things. But it is shocking because it looks, you know, very dangerous, like we could be very close to some sort of armed conflict with Iran. And within a very short time after him announcing pulling out of the deal, Israel attacked Iranian targets in Syria. And then Iran returned fire into the Golan Heights. And then Israel returned fire against them. So it's, you know, a very serious situation, which everyone should be very concerned about.
Go ahead, Ted.
Yeah, proxy wars aside, I think a lot of Americans are kind of unaware that Iran would not be a picnic or a cakewalk. Not that Afghanistan and Iraq were, but Iran has a real air force. It's a first world country, very modern military. It could defend itself. It's huge. It's half the size of Europe. And people just don't really understand. They tend to underestimate, I think, Americans do, the just what a formidable military and cultural adversary and economic powerhouse Iran really is. And so the consequences are huge. The one really amusing or weird thing that needs to be noted here has been the statement issued by the Europeans, the French, the Germans, and the Brits have been urging Iranians to adhere to the deal, even though the U.S. has pulled out of it, which is kind of hilarious. And I'm not really sure what's behind that. I don't know if we want to talk about that at all, but it is interesting.
Yeah, I actually would like to talk about that. I want to ask both of you about the Iranian reaction, because it seems to me that it's been very muted, actually. You know, as soon as this announcement was made at the White House, the Israelis began provoking the Syrians and the Iranians, and Iranians were killed in Syria. But the Iranians really, for the most part, haven't responded. Of course, there have been a couple of missiles fired into the Golan Heights. It's unclear whether it was the Syrians or the Iranians that did that. But in the greater scheme of things, I think there really hasn't been a response from the Iranians. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, well, I think there's a reason for that. Yes, it is. I would agree that the Iranian reaction has been very restrained, even with President Rouhani saying that he was going to try somehow to salvage the deal with the Europeans, though, as you suggest, that's going to be hard to do. But it has been restrained, and there's a reason for that. One, I think that, frankly, Iran is a much more reasonable country than people give it credit for. But two, the elephant in the living room is that Israel has, you know, 200 to 400 nuclear warheads. Iran has very little room to maneuver there. They know if they did anything crazy, like attack Israel proper, that they could be nuked. And that is the irony here. Iran has kept to the nuclear deal. They do not have nuclear weapons. They're not trying to get nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, Israel has nuclear weapons. And my fear is, frankly, Israel, to me, seems willing to possibly use them for the reason Ted said. A conventional war against Iran would be incredible. According to Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who's very much against what's happening, he said it would be Iraq times 10 or 15. You know, let that sink in.
Yeah, I think where we're going in the short term is an attempt to impose really, really severe economic sanctions on Iran with the goal of economically destabilizing the country and provoking unrest. That was exactly the playbook that the CIA and British intelligence used in 1952 and 53, leading to the overthrow of the Mossack Day government in Iran after it dared to nationalize what became British Petroleum. I'm looking at today's Wall Street Journal. U.S. raises pressure on Iran. The U.S. took a step towards cutting Iran off from the global economy, levying sanctions on a financing network, and accusing the country's central bank of helping funnel U.S. dollars to the blacklisted elite military unit known as the Quds Force. That's just the public rationale for these actions. Acting jointly with the United Arab Emirates, the U.S. Treasury Department imposed sanctions on several Iranian companies, individuals, and officials it said are operating on illegal currency exchange networks in the UAE. The sanctions were the first since President Donald Trump this week pulled out of the landmark Iran nuclear deal. What, Ted Rall, what Trump is basically saying, and Bolton and Pompeo are saying to the Europeans is, yeah, you guys wanted to be, you wanted to retain the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the arms deal, the Iran nuclear arms deal. But guess what? It's over, and you have to make a decision now. Do you want to trade with Iran? Do you want to trade with Iran's central bank? Or do you want to have access to the United States and its markets? And under those pressures, Europe is going to completely fold.
Certainly, that's right. Economically, there's no, it's not even something they have to break a sweat thinking about. However, there's also been some interesting analysis about how humiliating this has been for the Europeans, because they've been joined at the hip throughout this diplomatic process with the United States. And Trump keeps on one thing after another, making them look like fools. And this is just another example of it. He appears feckless. And it is, we are in the interesting position of having, the world is starting to see now that Iran is perhaps a more reasonable negotiating partner than the United States is, certainly under Donald Trump. And that's also interesting. I mean, in diplomacy, let's not forget here, the non-proliferation treaty that Iran is being held to account here over was signed in 1970 under the Shah of Iran, a government that was overthrown in 1979 under the Islamic Revolution. So, and nevertheless, the Islamic Republic decided to continue to honor its treaty obligations that it inherited from the Shah's era, which is pretty remarkable. Now, on the other hand, you have the United States, which one president ago negotiated the joint plan that we're all talking about here. And just because it's a different president from a different political party, the new president is fecklessly walking away from it and risking war with a major power, and already ramping up a proxy war in Syria. It's this is not a fine hour for the United States in the international community, and having anything to do with it doesn't make the Europeans look good either.
Yeah. Okay, let's turn to another subject. We're covering four big stories this week. We're joined by Dan Kovalik. He's a human rights lawyer and an author. He has an upcoming book about the U.S. basic threats against Iran. We're also talking to award-winning editorial cartoonist Ted Rall. Let's talk about the DPRK Trump summit. Finally, the date has been set for Singapore's June 12th. Now, the Koreans, the North Koreans, and I believe the South Koreans, Dan, wanted this meeting to happen at Panmunjom. They wanted to have it at the DMZ. And then after the conclusion of those talks, Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, who's helped drive this process, would have been available to join Trump and Kim Jong-un in three-way talks. But it was the U.S. that insisted on Singapore. Now, Singapore is a friendly country to the United States, although it has a sort of neutral reputation. Anyway, is there any significance to the choice of location?
Well, certainly. I mean, first of all, the fact that Trump is willing to meet with the leader of North Korea is, it's unprecedented. No president has done that since, the end of the Korean conflict in 1953. So that is an incredible event in and of itself. I think, honestly, I think given that there's a lot of pushback on that alone, including mostly from the Democrats, which is kind of interesting, that it probably would have been hard for him to meet in the DMZ itself, I think. But I think the fact, truthfully, that he's meeting at all is a welcome thing. I mean, again, this is very much in contrast to his collision course with Iran. He seems to want to do something productive with the Korean Peninsula, which I certainly applaud. And it looks like the South Koreans are very interested in it. The polls show that 80% of South Koreans now have a favorable view of North Korea and its leader. And I give a lot of credit to the South Koreans, who frankly made this happen by pushing out their former president, Park, and voting in Moon, who wanted to make this happen.
Ted Rall, it is fairly breathtaking that here we had in September, Donald Trump was at the podium at the General Assembly of the United Nations, calling Kim Jong-un Little Rocket Man and threatening from the UN podium to totally annihilate DPRK, something that the U.S. actually did during the Korean War. And here we are, June 12th, a summit between Kim Jong-un, the head of state of North Korea, and the president of the United States. The first time anything like this has ever happened. And it seems to me that you have Kim Jong-un, he's gone twice now to China. He's met with Xi Jinping. He's strengthened the relationship or restored the relationship to, you know, which had soured somewhat between DPRK and China. If anything, if this summit falls apart, if Trump walks away, it seems to me that DPRK is still in a stronger position, given the fact that they seem to have been the ones to try to make a go of it. Which, of course, would be important for them, because even though the UN sanctions are very intense and very comprehensive, China and Russia, both of which share a border with the DPRK, could unofficially loosen those sanctions. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, blessed are the peacemakers, and their poll numbers go up, too. I think, you know, that's one of the things that maybe George W. Bush never really realized, is that people really do want peace, and they don't want war most of the time. So, for sure, Kim's in a stronger position now. And, you know, you mentioned Trump's crazy rhetoric just a few months ago. Well, you know, Kim's rhetoric was up there, too. The official, you know, it was things were the official statements coming out of the DPRK were very bellicose, as they always sort of historically have been. And we're in a much better place here. I think the world has grounds to be optimistic. I don't know what's going to come out of it. I was reading analysis today in the New York Times arguing that Kim wants to be his country's Deng Xiaoping, the man who brings capitalism or neoliberalism to North Korea and starts to take apart what remains of the socialist state there. If that's the case, then, you know, it's going to have implications that won't all be positive. But there's nevertheless, I guess this kind of validates the outcome here, if it goes the way we all hope, would partly validate the sort of old-fashioned, you know, let's soften them up with rhetoric and before we negotiate, and then they'll be more reasonable. The other side will be more reasonable when they come to the bargaining table.
Yeah, John Kiriakou, Ted Rall's right about that point, that people in the United States actually want peace. And Donald Trump's approval rating on North Korea is higher than it is on almost any other issue.
Crazy.
It's a 55% approve that. Trump has like ripped up the Paris Climate Treaty. He's pulled out of the TPP. He just ripped up the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear arms deal. He's ripped up everything. NAFTA is basically in the trash can. And yet here, what's Trump looking for? He wants to be the man. It seems to me he wants to have something that shows that he's accomplished something on the international level.
And there's all this silly chatter now about a Nobel Peace Prize. You know how much Donald Trump hates Barack Obama. And Obama got a peace prize just because he wasn't George W. Bush. And I think that it's really in Donald Trump's head that he has to get a Nobel Peace Prize, and this is the easiest way to do it. This is far easier than making peace with Iran, especially after all the rhetoric. So I think that he sees this as something that can really give him his place in history. Remember, only Nixon could go to China. Well, maybe only Trump can go to North Korea. At least that's the way he sees it. I think that's the road that we're headed down right now. And my only fear is that this is going to succeed to a point where the American people ignore everything else. Because we all want peace in Korea. That would be a wonderful thing. So let's say that there is peace in Korea. That doesn't do anything about Iran or TPP or NAFTA or any of these other issues that you just raised. And I think that's the way Donald Trump wants it.
Go ahead, Dan.
Well, in fact, I mean, you could have an ironic event with Trump receiving the Nobel Peace Prize as the U.S. is bombing Iran. I mean, that, you know, something that crazy is fully possible here.
Yeah, let's turn to another story. One very close for you, John, and that's the Gina Haspel confirmation hearings. Your op-ed in the Washington Post back in March has really been a major catalyst for all kinds of opposition, grassroots, progressive opposition. Even that amazing letter from more than 110 former or retired Pentagon officials saying Gina Haspel shouldn't be nominated. And then the hearings themselves were really something.
Very
not
telling.
So much because of, well, maybe let's talk about what Congress asked and what she said, besides the platitudes. But also, you know, Ray McGovern, former CIA official, sort of spoke out against her nomination, and he was really brutally taken down.
He really was. There's so much to talk about here. I knew I would be disappointed in Gina Haspel's testimony, and I think a lot of Democrats on the Senate Intelligence Committee also were disappointed because they gave her ample opportunity to say that she had been wrong. They gave her ample opportunity to apologize for her role in the CIA's torture program, and she refused. She doubled down. And I think that that convinced some people that she's wrong for this job, while Joe Manchin, the conservative Democrat from West Virginia, had already said he was going to vote in favor of her. John McCain came out and said that he would vote against. And now Jeff Flake, the other senator, the junior senator from Arizona, said that he has the deepest respect for John McCain and for his position on this issue. So it looks like Flake might be a no vote, too. But again, it's the Democrats we can't trust. So there's a real danger of Democrats who are running for re-election in states that Donald Trump carried, that they would vote yes. Tim Kaine, Hillary Clinton's vice presidential nominee, said just a few hours ago that he would vote no. That's a big deal because he's an Intelligence Committee member, as is the senior senator from Virginia, Mark Warner. But we don't know yet where John Tester is on this issue, or Bill Nelson, or Joe Donnelly, or any of these other moderate or conservative Democrats. Doug Jones from Alabama hasn't said one way or the other. Another disappointment for me on this issue is that Susan Collins, the moderate Republican from Maine, said that she would support Haspel. And I was really counting on her to do the right thing. So I hate to say it, but I think Haspel's going to win in committee. I think she's going to win on the floor of the Senate by 2 or 3 votes. But let's talk real quickly about Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern got up during the hearing and said something in opposition to Gina Haspel. We're not even really sure what it was. And he was utterly brutalized.
He's 78 years old.
78 years old, brutalized by the Capitol Police. They threw him onto the ground. They dislocated his shoulder. They made him spend the night in jail.
And the next day.
And the next day. And he wasn't even arraigned and released until that evening.
Last night.
And he's being charged with a felony. And for what? Because he expressed an opinion against torture and against Gina Haspel's role in it.
Go ahead, Ted.
What happened to Ray McGovern is worth noting and is really disgusting. And it's so ironic considering what we're talking about here. The official liberal / Democratic / reasonable, quote, I put that in air quotes, position on Gina Haspel is that if only she will say the right words, if only she will renounce torture, then it'll be okay to vote for her because of her stellar career in intelligence. What no one is saying is that the fact that she had such a key leading role, not only in waterboarding, where she directly supervised, she was in the room where it was happening over and over again. But on top of that, in a conspiracy to cover up by destroying the videotaped evidence of that torture so that no one could ever be prosecuted, those should be disqualifying on their face. She shouldn't be she shouldn't be confirmed for any high office. She should be in prison. And that is the only moral position. I don't care if you're a Democrat, Republican, or anything else. And it's crazy that we live in a Wally world where we can't even have that position articulated, much less be the majority position.
Yeah, nobody said that in the hearings, right?
Nobody said that.
John Kiriakou, Dan, went to prison for more than 2 years because he exposed the torture program. Ray McGovern just got the heck beaten out of him and dislocated his shoulder. He went to jail for protesting torture. And here you have Gina Haspel, who's being treated with, even sort of semi-tough questions were considered like a big deal, and they weren't that tough. But yeah, Gina Haspel and torture should go to jail. Anyway, your view, Dan.
Yeah, well, I think it's a very dark moment for U.S. history. I think that, honestly, my reaction is that the Republic is dead. I mean, that you have all the things you say, you know, people being brutalized because they oppose torture, and whereas people who support torture are going to get high office. It just leaves me speechless, and I think it leaves the rest of the world speechless. I think we have lost our moral authority. We are left as a very strong and dangerous military power with no moral authority behind us, and that is a very dangerous situation.
Ted Rall, let's go to, in our last 90 seconds or so, we wanted to spend a little bit more time. Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's personal lawyer until recently, a Russian firm, you know, it's an oligarch if the billionaire is Russian. That's the only person who's called an oligarch now. He gave $500,000 to Michael Cohen, but so did AT&T, so did Novartis. I mean, this guy is pay to play. The story has devolved. It started as Russiagate, but it's really just, it's the swamp. Go ahead, Ted.
As an AT&T customer, I want a partial rebate of those funds. That's all I have to say. It's true. I mean, look, pay to play is, that's the way our government works. I kind of like it when these things come out because it's a reminder of just how corrupt the system is, because people, they want to forget it. We live in denial. I mean, we live in a terrible, under a really terrible government, in a terrible system. And it's the sooner we can focus on it, then the sooner we can change it and do something different. So it's not a bad thing. Michael Cohen should get after the revolution, deserves a statue.
Yeah. AT&T gave him $800,000 because Trump had said during the 2016 campaign, the merger that they wanted with Time Warner shouldn't go through, that it would be too big, they'd be too powerful, too much concentration. And then I think the CEO of AT&T started, who was a Republican, started supporting Hillary Clinton in the last 2 months before the election. Then she shockingly lost. Then they fired that guy, or he resigned, and they gave $800,000 to Michael Cohen, who actually had no influence with Donald Trump, but because he had the title Donald Trump's personal lawyer. And AT&T has now sent a letter to its employees explaining why they spent $800,000 for Michael Cohen. Anyway, that's all the time we have. We've been joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. Dan is a human rights and labor lawyer. He's the author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. He has a new book coming out about Iran. And we've been talking from New York City with Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. There were primary elections this week in Ohio, Indiana, North Carolina, West Virginia, and elsewhere that saw mainstream Republicans win their party's nominations. For the most part, that's bad news for Democrats, and although the House of Representatives looks by all indicators ready to flip to the Democrats, they are poised to lose several seats to the Republicans in the Senate. We're joined here in the studio by Jacqueline Lukman. She's the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out the Lukman Nation live stream every Thursday night at 9 o'clock on Facebook. Jackie, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's start with some of these primary races. The big surprise, I think, was the fact that Don Blankenship lost his Senate primary in West Virginia. I think that's a great thing for the country.
Yeah, that's a great thing.
Whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, it's a great thing. The last-minute polls that were released showing him 1 to 3 points ahead just were incorrect.
Yeah.
And he lost pretty handily. But that makes trouble for Joe Manchin, the Democratic incumbent senator in that state, because now you've got a mainstream Republican running against him in a state that gave Donald Trump his biggest margin of victory in all of America.
The West Virginia primary was I think it was looked at as a barometer on the morals or the soul, I guess, of the Republican Party. How far right or how far down into the depths of depravity the Republican Party would go? Would they actually nominate someone like a Blankenship? But like we said before, we didn't think he was going to win.
No.
But the fact that he did get 20% of the vote.
Wow.
Says a lot about the GOP's image and identity problem. But you're also right about Manchin, because now he's facing an opponent who is clearly not as scary and not as horrible as Blankenship. So now Blankenship, kind of like Trump, has set the standard for how bad things could get. And as long as you're not as bad as that, then you're acceptable.
Yeah, there was another story within that Republican primary race in West Virginia, too. The other two Republicans that were running were Representative Evan Jenkins. He's a conservative Republican, and Attorney General Patrick Morrissey, who is a conservative Republican. Well, Morrissey successfully used Jenkins' congressional record against him, which is funny because they essentially agreed on every issue,
yes,
at least every issue of import. It looks like this may have been a backlash against Washington, even
yes,
though Jenkins was a conservative and was actually a good fit for West Virginia. They threw him out.
Yes, because we're seeing this populist, and I don't even know that it's really a correct term, because it's something other than populism. It's this weird idealistic nationalism,
yeah,
that is backed by a militaristic evangelical fervor that really has almost no basis in reality or actual policy. Because like you said, you've got Republican candidates whose voting records are almost identical. But they can come out and say, well, this guy or this other person isn't really a conservative.
Right.
But they also,
I hate Washington more than he does.
Exactly. But they also know that their base, they're not going to do their homework. Nobody's going to read.
No.
I will read the congressional record to
yes,
look at, you know, I'll read
Politico. 99% of voters will not.
But their voters will not. And I think another great example of that was in another race where you had a Republican in, I think it's in Massachusetts, where, no, I'm sorry, it's in North Carolina, where,
yeah,
you had a Republican.
I was going to talk about that one next.
Yeah.
Well, an incumbent Republican,
yes,
congressman,
yes,
thrown out and defeated by an evangelical former pastor.
Yes. And I was incorrect a couple of days ago when I said that a pastor lost. But no, the pastor won. And that is actually key, because he recognizes that for these evangelicals, the conservative evangelicals, to come out and vote, all he has to do is say that this person is supportive of Planned Parenthood, and, mm-hmm, this person supports amnesties, and this person,
right,
supports sanctuary city, none of which was true of the actual incumbent.
Well, that has a long history in American politics. There's,
mm-hmm,
a very famous story about Claude Pepper. Claude Pepper,
right,
had been a senator from the late 1940s. He had been a senator from Florida. He was a Democrat and a progressive Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
They called them liberal Democrats in those days, and a great champion of the elderly. And George Mathers, another Democrat, decided to run against him in the Democratic primary. Well, Pepper was popular and he was a good senator. So what Mathers did was he released a radio commercial saying that Pepper's sister was an avowed thespian in New York City.
She was a public actress.
Yeah, which was true. She was a Broadway actress.
Right, right.
But Floridians in 1954 or 56,
had
whenever, they didn't know
idea
the difference between thespian and lesbian. And so Pepper lost.
Exactly.
Now,
and
he was elected to the House of Representatives later and spent the rest of his life in the House, but he never forgave Smathers for that. That's a dirty trick that is still being used today, and we
exactly
saw it in that North Carolina race.
Exactly. And what's incredibly insulting, what's even dirtier than the dirty trick that was used by Harris in North Carolina, was the fact that he's openly just insulting his,
yeah,
voter base.
Right.
He's basically just telling them, I know you are too stupid,
yes,
to do the research yourself. So I'm just going to stand here and tell you these lies about this man.
That is exactly what happened.
I can win this seat. And I have to tell you, as a Christian myself, I am appalled that there are still large segments of so-called evangelical Christians who fall for this trick. But again, we're talking about a section of the country, especially in the GOP, that is largely white and very still holds on to very racist, nationalistic, separatist, militaristic ideas. So any indication that any candidate, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, supports the other in any way is an automatic just and torpedoing of that person.
Throw in those buzzwords that you mentioned a few minutes ago, amnesty,
yes,
sanctuary cities, mm-hmm. and you've lost the race. I want to point out, too, another thing we should be thinking about in this North Carolina race that we're talking about is that Congressman Pittenger, the Republican incumbent, he mm-hmm. lost by less than 200 votes to this pastor.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, the Supreme Court has ordered that North Carolina's congressional district boundaries be redrawn.
Right.
So I think that this pastor, what's his name here? I had it right in front of me.
Is it Mark Harris?
Yes, Mark Harris. Mm-hmm. Mark Harris is going to run in a district that will be decidedly different than the one that gave him this primary victory.
Yes. And that's where the true test of what his actual policies are will have to come to fore. I have no idea what's going to happen in that race because I don't know what the district is going to look like after it's redrawn. But these kinds of easy, intellectually lazy, ideological wins that some of these upstart GOP candidates are willing to amass is it's just trouble for the GOP. This is not a good look for the grand old party.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Let's talk about the grand old party and the way it looks in Ohio. So
yeah.
we spent a lot of time over the last couple of weeks talking about this primary race in the northern suburbs of Columbus. This is a deep red congressional district, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden, the Democrat is at least neck and neck in the polls.
Yes.
It was unclear until Tuesday what Republican was going to run against this Democrat, and as it turned out, it's the mainstream mm-hmm. Republican that all the state Republican elected officials wanted to see win. It's
right.
not the outsider.
Right.
That tells me that people realize that they may have stepped a little bit too far beyond the bounds and they're beginning to come back into the fold.
I think that is true in some places. It's
yes,
hard
not
to
in all places.
Not in all places. It's really hard to gauge where that's going to happen and where that isn't going to happen, which is what makes this midterm so, honestly, I got to tell you, it's a little frightening because I'm not sure what this means about our electorate anymore. On the other hand, I think these kinds of volcanic or unpredictable sort of races where we can't tell what the outcome is going to be because we just have no idea what the voting populace is going to do, I think that's actually a good indicator of the kinds of problems that we've ignored in this country in politics for decades.
And you
decades.
Know what? That's the nature of our system. And I would say that one of the things that pushed us into this corner was the Citizens United decision
Absolutely.
At the Supreme Court.
Absolutely.
It's literally wrecked our electoral system.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only people, and I use air quotes around the word people, who have a voice in politics are the big corporations that have the big money.
That's right. I mean, in so many races and so many primaries, we are seeing all of these candidates who are able to fund their own campaigns.
Yep.
I don't think we've ever seen this number of just filthy rich people getting into politics.
Let's talk about
local
that.
Levels.
Sheldon Adelson is a very well-known benefactor of the mm-hmm. Republican Party. He is an ardent Zionist, and he's actually paying for the U.S. to move its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He's paying for it out of his own pocket.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years ago, he donated $10 million to the Republican National Committee for use in congressional races.
Right.
He announced yesterday, I think it was, day before yesterday, that he's going to donate $30 million to help the Republicans
maintain their control of the House of Representatives. What do you think about that?
I think it is a perfect example of the problems with, like you said, a legislation like Citizens United. But it's also a perfect example of what happened after the 1996 Telecommunications Act. I think it was in 1996, because Sheldon Adelson made his money off of buying media companies.
Yes, that's right.
So he was able to amass this enormous fortune that he's using to basically bankroll a political party, a national political party, in down ballot races with money that he was able to make from being a media mogul. That wouldn't have happened before 1996, the Telecommunications Act that came out of the Clinton administration.
Right.
So here we have another example of one American citizen who has very close to, you want to talk about Russia being a problem. How about the fact that as you said, Sheldon Adelson is an ardent Zionist. At the meeting where he announced this $30 million contribution to the congressional campaign,
the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee.
Right. Representatives of AIPAC and the Republican Jewish organization, I think that's what they're, the Republican Jewish Fund or Republican Jewish League, were in attendance at this meeting. These are our political operatives. I hesitate to call this man a leader, but we have representatives of foreign governments in meetings. Or people who are liaising with foreign government in meetings where people are deciding who they're going to fund for congressional races. That's a problem.
And this Adelson money is what's known in politics as outside money.
Yes.
It's not like Sheldon Adelson lives in, let's say, South Carolina's 3rd district, right? Or Ohio's 12th district.
Right.
But by God, he's going to donate the maximum amount of money to influence the race there.
And it's amazing that one person can donate this amount of money to a political party.
Perfectly legal.
And it's perfectly legal, but people had a problem with how Bernie Sanders raised his money.
Right. $5 at a time.
Five, 27, 10 bucks at a time. And that was some type of scandal. So all of this coming together in this really bizarre alternate universe midterm is just a perfect example. It's just everything that's wrong with American politics being laid bare. And I don't want anyone to think that I don't have the same criticisms for Democrats.
Oh, no, I'm with you.
Who are, you know, because I think the DNC was absolutely right in demanding that Hillary Clinton pay back the money.
Absolutely.
That went to her campaign instead of going to down ballot races. So, yeah, there is an enormous problem.
And, this is, I don't want to get too afield, but this is an ongoing problem with the Democrats. You remember Howard Dean, when he was the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, was ridiculed because he wanted to spend money to rebuild state Democratic organizations in traditionally Republican states.
Absolutely.
James Carville, the Democratic strategist, was especially harsh in his comments about Howard Dean, because Dean said, well, we need to have a Democratic Party organization in South Dakota or in Montana or Idaho or Utah. Frankly, he was right, because oftentimes it's those state and local party apparatuses that get people elected at the state legislature level.
Absolutely.
Or maybe get somebody elected Secretary of State or Lieutenant Governor or Governor.
Right.
Well, if you have no Democratic Party in that state, then you're not going to have any Democratic elected officials. So here we are again, where the Democrats have made this decision. They did it during Hillary Clinton's control of the DNC. They made this decision to ignore Republican states. That's the death knell for a party.
It is. And we are seeing it played out even right now with the recent vote to scrap the Consumer Protection Board's decision or rule on making it harder for auto lenders to discriminate against minority buyers. Now, I didn't listen to the entire testimony, So, you know, a big deal is being made about what Maxine Waters said on the floor. So I don't know what she said before the comments from this Trump-supporting congressman basically said, we need to stop talking about discrimination. And that's how we need to start talking about the nation, and we're coming together regardless of what you say. The Democrats have conceded the fight for values, actual values that help actual people, for the same kinds of ideological talking points that Republicans have used, but it's been disastrous for them.
Yeah.
So instead of responding to this crazy man's comments with facts, you know, no, we can't not talk about discrimination, because the data has shown that even lenders or borrowers, rather, of color, who have the requisite income and excellent credit scores, they're still charged higher interest rates and more monies.
Yes.
Money by auto lenders. Instead of saying that, you know, we have Maxine Waters, who, of course, she had a right to be angry, but her only response was, well, I'm more offended than you'll ever be. No, he said, we have to not talk about discrimination. And the Democrats' response has always got to be the facts. And too frequently, their only response is, no, you're terrible.
Yes.
And that's just not working.
No.
For the Democrats.
It's been like that for years. And that's why so many young Democrats, newly elected Democrats, or Democrats who expect to win their, let's say, their House seats, mm-hmm. or their House races, I should say, want a change in that leadership. You know, Nancy Pelosi is something like 78 years old.
Yes.
Steny Hoyer, 78 years old. Jim Clyburn, 76 years old. Mm-hmm. It's time for them to go.
It really is time for them to go, because while they may still be very passionate in supporting the Democratic Party.
Yes, and good at fundraising.
And great at fundraising, they're bad at carrying the Democratic message to a new generation of Democratic voters.
We've said on this program so many times, did the Democrats learn nothing from the contract with America in 1994? The Republicans knew exactly what they were doing.
Yes.
They came up with this gimmick, this mm-hmm. contract with America, that was essentially just a one sheet page of campaign promises.
Right.
And they kept their promises.
Yes.
And people elected them. And it was the first time in something like 40 years that the Republicans had controlled the House of Representatives.
And we have situations now where that lack of democratic, solid democratic messaging based on policy that connects to people, where you've got people in Massachusetts. Now, the GOP has a terrible image problem.
Yeah. In fact, there are no Republicans in the House of Representatives from Massachusetts.
None. But in the GOP primary in, I think it's Massachusetts, the candidate Scott Lively actually wrote a book claiming that the Holocaust was implemented by gay Nazis. This book, it's a real book. He actually wrote it. He does not disavow this.
Yeah, please don't buy that book on
Amazon.com. Don't buy that book. Don't do it. But he managed to receive 15% of the congressional committee vote in Massachusetts, which was twice as much as was needed to be on the ballot. He's now going to be on the ballot in their primary in September.
There's this elderly man running in a South Chicago district as a Republican
mm-hmm.
who is a Nazi and a former member of the American Nazi Party.
Yes.
I saw him interviewed on CNN recently, and the anchor called him a neo-Nazi. And he said, I'm not a neo-Nazi.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And he won the Republican nomination. Now, he's not going to win that race.
No.
But by God, he's going to get 15 or 20% of the vote.
And there is a serious problem. This is absolutely an image problem for the GOP. But my bigger worry is with the Democrats, because they have no answer for these kinds of people.
That's it.
They act as if these kinds of people feeling comfortable enough to run openly in any political apparatus in this country is not a problem. And while I understand that, you know, everything, when you're the hammer, everything can't be the nail. You know, the Democratic Party is the other massive wing of our political party, of our political apparatus in this country. So they can't pay attention to every single thing. But the kinds of ideals these people, like this Scott Lively in Massachusetts and this guy in I think it's wherever he was, Indiana. I hope he just goes away.
Illinois.
Illinois. Yeah. They represent ideologies that are dangerous to people. And when people see Democrats not responding to these people at all, they see the Democrats as weak.
Yeah, they do. They do. I want to talk about another couple of races. I want to dispense with one very quickly.
Yeah.
Vice President Pence's brother won the Republican nomination for a congressional seat in Indiana. It's a solidly Republican seat. Does that matter at all that there's going to be another Pence in Congress?
It does matter. I think it absolutely matters because here again, we're talking about another political dynasty in the making.
Mm-hmm.
And I swear, I thought we fought a war, not to be like Britain, but here we are. Completely okay. But again, this goes back to the conservative evangelical fervor that is still very strong in these kinds of districts like in Indiana. Pence is obviously the poster child for white conservative Republican,
yes,
Christianity.
Evangelical, yes.
Yes.
And so Barack Obama winning Indiana in 2008 was a fluke.
I don't know that it was a fluke as much as his messaging was so generic that,
You may be onto something there.
I think I had to go back and listen to his campaign speeches, and I had to be honest because I voted for him the first time, and the second time I just couldn't bring myself to do it because I recognized that there was a serious problem, that his messaging was so generic that it was unoffensive to anyone who didn't want to hear that there are problems that we still need to address politically in this country. So I don't think his election, his winning Indiana or any other red state was a fluke. I think it was just third way DLC, Democratic Leadership Committee strategy,
mm-hmm,
that they kept using. They just dismantled the organization, but the strategy remained the same.
It was the same strategy.
It was the same strategy.
We've got about 5 minutes left, and I want to talk about the Senate race in Florida. We really haven't spent any time on this race because it frankly always seemed to me that Senator Bill Nelson was going to cruise to reelection. Well, now it looks like that may not be the case. Now, he's running against Governor Rick Scott. This is a guy that's worth $150 million. He, mm-hmm, self-finances all of his races.
Mm-hmm.
His poll numbers go between, you know, bad and good and bad and good, but he's usually hovering around 50% approval. He's very polarizing because he's very conservative. And, you know, Florida is as purple a state as there is. Well, the latest poll, and this is a poll that is current to yesterday, shows him beating Bill Nelson by 4 percentage points, 44 to 40. What do you think about that?
I think what helped Rick Scott was his response to the Parkland massacre.
Ah, yes.
I do think that I almost hate to say it because I don't like him that much, but his decisive action on common sense gun regulations boosted him enough in the polls among people who are focused on that issue that they look at him as not such a bad guy. And would give him another chance. I think that helped him.
I think you're probably right.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's interesting when we look at, you know, incumbents and these midterm elections, we can't assume anymore that anybody is going to coast to victory.
No, not anymore.
It is. Everything is such a toss-up.
Yeah, just ask Roy Moore about that.
and that's not always bad.
Right.
Because like we just said, some of these people really do have to go because they've been in office for too long and there needs to be fresh blood and fresh ideas.
Ideologically, I have always been opposed to term limits because I've always argued that we have term limits. They're called, mm-hmm, elections.
Yes.
But you know what? I've come around to the fact that that's just not true anymore. Big corporate money plays such a pivotal role in our, mm-hmm, elections now that we really do need term limits because that's the only way we can keep big companies from taking over.
Yes, yes. And I think we need term limits for most offices, from the governor to school board, everything.
And most states have term limits, mm-hmm, for governor. Of course, we have a national term limit for president.
Right.
There's no reason why the House and Senate shouldn't have term limits.
I think we absolutely need them. And we also need to reconstitute our efforts to overturn Citizens United.
Absolutely.
It was a disaster of a piece of legislation. And we're all feeling the effects of that right now, where people are buying political office.
Oh, yes.
And none of them are doing it with the intention of actually legislating for the people.
No.
They're just not.
No.
It's just political office is the golden parachute for these people.
It is.
That's all it is.
Which is funny because salary wise, they don't really make that much money. And then they have to maintain two homes. But somehow when they finish, they're all rich.
Well, it's because they get to legislate policies that make them and their supporters and their friends in high places even more money.
Absolutely true. What do you think we should be looking at in the coming week?
Oh, in the coming week, I do think we should continue to look at the Georgia races. That's an incredibly hot race.
And Georgia is another state that very quietly is beginning to trend purple.
Yes. Yes. There's a lot of turmoil in the Georgia race. I'm going to look at it more closely this week. I'm also going to look some more at North Carolina because we've got McCrory, who is no longer the governor, who's saying some pretty obviously racist things because he's angry that more black people are winning political office in North Carolina, even though the governor is still white. But North Carolina has a long history of voter suppression.
A very ugly history.
That was not successful, but it's not as if they're stopping. So those are, I think, some very key races that we need to look at and just continue to look at the implosion of the GOP. I do think it is falling in on itself, caving in on itself, and to look at the Democratic Party to see how the progressives are faring. And they're not faring well. The establishment
Democrats are really not faring well.
Yeah, the establishment Democrats are holding on to power with everything they have. And that does not spell a very good outcome for American voters.
Well, I am going to try this coming week to watch the Texas Senate race between Ted Cruz and Beto O'Rourke. We've discussed him in previous installments of this show. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually interested in the special election in Mississippi. The mayor of Tupelo, Mississippi, a Democrat, dropped out of the race, and he's pretty much left the nomination to Mike Espy, a former Clinton-era Secretary of Agriculture, former congressman, six-term congressman from Mississippi, who actually may have a shot at this thing. Hmm. So we're going to have to end it there. We were joined here in the studio by Jacqueline Lukman. She is the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out the Lukman Nation live stream every Thursday night at 9 o'clock p.m. on Facebook. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.